Hi, it's Dave. Welcome. Today I'm joined by Jacob Shapiro. He is the Director of Geopolitical Analysis at Cognitive Investments. He also is the director and founder of Perch Perspectives, doing consulting for businesses and also political policy. So I wanted to welcome Jacob on the show. We've got a lot to talk about. We have the Ukraine-Russian war, we've got commodities, the markets, and we've got a bigger backdrop of geopolitical conflict and international risks. So Jacob, welcome to the show. How are you doing?
I'm doing good. It's not like there's anything going on. I've been getting plenty of sleep.
Exactly. All right. So before we get started, can you kind of just give a quick background of how you got started with, you know, geopolitical analysis? What is your history?
Yeah, it's really backwards, actually. It's interesting you ask. So I never thought I was going to be doing this. I thought I was going to be an academic. But I graduated into the 2008 financial crisis with a degree in Middle Eastern studies, and my specialty was actually medieval Islamist philosophy. Anyway, so I got an internship at Stratfor, of all places, the global intelligence firm, and I was making coffee there for a while. And I was making coffee as an intern there right when the Arab Spring kicked out. And it just so happened that knowing Arabic and knowing some things about Islamic theology and all these other things was good for global intelligence at the time that the Arab Spring kicked off. So I started as a Middle East analyst at Stratfor, and officially in 2010 or 2011, and kind of never looked back. I've been doing geopolitics and just kind of expanding my knowledge of from the Middle East to the world ever since.
Got it. How did you pick up Arabic?
I went to Cornell University and spent 4 years learning about it and getting a degree in Near Eastern studies.
So. Got it. And then did you live abroad in the region at all?
No, not really. I mean, okay. I was actually planning on going to Egypt right around the time the Arab Spring kicked off. And that obviously fell through, and it wasn't a very good time to do that. But no, I've never actually lived in the region.
Okay, got it. So my understanding is a lot of your work deals with not just analyzing geopolitical situations, conflict, et cetera, but also analyzing clients' businesses on specific action items regarding maybe their strategies of expanding or doing businesses in certain regions. Can you kind of describe a little bit of your work in that regard?
Sure. It's extremely varied, as you can tell by both of my titles. So for instance, at Cognitive Investments, most of my analysis is being used to generate macro strategies in the market. So understanding what countries are doing well, what countries are not doing well, that also kind of bleeds into commodities and currencies and understanding how political risk is intersecting with those things. In the corporate sphere, it's really about, these days, it's been about supply chains, because a lot of companies for a long time have been relying on China and just kind of expecting that China was going to soak up whatever needs they had, whether it was the market they were going to sell into or where they were going to assemble their products. And the U.S.-China trade war really kind of woke people up to the fact that the world was changing and that the world was becoming more multipolar. So a lot of what I'm doing is helping companies figure out, where do we move to? What are good places to move to? What are bad ideas or what are bad places to move to? How do different political policies, protectionist policies, conflicts affect my bottom line? How likely is it these things are going to happen? So it really runs the gamut. Most of our clients right now are either sort of in the agricultural sector or in the manufacturing sector, because those are kind of two of the places where geopolitics is asserting itself most significantly. But you'd be hard pressed, I think, today to find, especially in the context of this Russia-Ukraine war, to find an industry that is not being affected by this. And I mean, it's somewhat self-serving to say this, of course, but I think this is going to be touching everyone, that we're really just at the beginning of a period of geopolitical competition, not anywhere near a resolution point.
Yeah. I was watching one of your videos. It was from several years ago, and you were saying how you think that we are at a beginning stage of some sorts of increasing geopolitical conflict. What's the background? What's the backdrop that has led to a situation where, for a lot of people, you know, this Ukraine-Russia war is a wake-up call to international risk that maybe we haven't been exposed to in many, many years in the markets. But for the first time in a while, it matters, and it's giving a lot of jitters to people. But you've seen this, you know, kind of not just pop up or not just come out of nowhere, but it's been a trend that you've noticed over the past several years of increased risk with geopolitical conflict, tensions, et cetera. So what's the backdrop? Like, what can you share in terms of trying to help us understand the bigger picture?
Yeah, it's funny. I was talking with a friend in contact in Eastern Europe just today about this, and he made a point to me that I thought was very good that I'll steal, which was that Basically, a whole generation has grown up thinking that the world is peaceful and that everything is kind of free and cheap, and it's just about people maximizing efficiency, and you kind of go from there. And that's honestly an aberration. When you look back at the history of the last couple centuries or even further back, you have these peaceful periods, but most of the time somebody's fighting somebody or there is some global instability that's taken hold. I think if you're looking at it from the highest possible altitude, the way to think about this is that the last 30 years or so, and we can quibble over where to put the end of the era. You could put it in 2008. You could argue it was Brexit. You could argue it was Trump. It kind of doesn't matter exactly what your demarcation is. But that was the unipolar era. It was the Pax Americana. It was where the United States was unambiguously the most powerful country in the world from a political perspective, economic perspective, military perspective. Now, I don't think the U.S. is in decline. I don't go towards that sort of argument, but I do think the U.S. position relative to a lot of other powers in the world is changing. It's actually getting stronger compared to some countries. It's getting weaker compared to others, mostly because countries like China or like India are rising. And so when we look at the world, it's not really going to be a unipolar world anymore between sort of with just the U.S. at the center. It's also not going to be a bipolar world. So before the last 30 years, it was really the Cold War was what defined things. And it was you had the United States versus the Soviet Union, and everybody had to kind of fill in which block they wanted to join. For me, we have to go further back for a mental map. And I've been insisting to folks for a couple of years now that the right mental map is the world before World War One. So think about the 1880s and the 1890s. Where you had a lot of shifting pragmatic relationships, you had rising and falling great powers. One of my favorite examples to trot out is that you know, the Germans and the British Empire knew that they were on a collision course, but they kept on trading with each other more and more and more right up until they declared war on each other. It was this kind of in-between phase. And that was also, you had global imperialism, folks running around the world trying to pick up the resources and commodities to help them power forward with the Industrial Revolution. I just think there's so many analogies between what we're seeing today and that period of the 1890s. So at the most sort of top level, the thing that's happening here is there's no longer a top dog who's calling all the shots, and you've got all these countries jockeying for position, trying to set themselves up well for the decades ahead. Mm-hmm.
So in your view, it's not just a simple U.S. like versus China issue. You're looking at it through a more complex lens, I'm seeing, right? I mean, like, for example, India, maybe East Asia, maybe Europe still has relevance, et cetera. Like, in terms of a multipolar world, do you see, you know, a good 3, 4, or 5 type of, you know, major blocks forming? Or, like, what's the construct that you're seeing right now?
Yeah, and we're still at the very beginning stages of this, so it's somewhat amorphous and it's going to change over time. I'm not one of these people who's going to come on and tell you I have a crystal ball and these are the countries and they will go to war in 2028. But based on what we're seeing today, I think the three ones we can be fairly certain about are the United States. It's not going anywhere. China, for certain, it's got, I think, a couple difficult years ahead of it, but I expect China to get through the domestic economic problems it's having right now and to kind of assert itself as a power on that level. And the European Union, I think, is going to be a geopolitical actor. For a long time, for decades, really, the European countries were squabbling with each other over things that were really ultimately not that important. And now, in the span of just a couple of weeks, they've realized, well, wait, the threats that are all around us actually outweigh whatever differences we have internally. So I think you're beginning to see right now Europe come together and be that kind of strong force. Beyond that, there's a couple of countries that I would point to that we have to watch. I'm supremely interested in Turkey and what's going to happen there. Erdogan is a very interesting leader. I think he soaks up a lot of the headlines. But if you just forget him for a second and look at where Turkey is on the map, what its economy looks like relative to its neighbors, the military bases that it's building throughout Northern Africa and through a lot of these sea lanes. I think Turkey has a big role in the future ahead. India and Brazil are both countries that have tremendous internal challenges, but also have tremendous potential if they could ever put things together. Indonesia also kind of falls in that bucket. They have even more serious challenges when you look at that. South Africa is a wild card. South Africa is blessed with a lot of different mineral commodities. It has an excellent geopolitical situation. It has been tripping over itself politically for a generation. If it could resolve that, it could have something to say about this. So there's a lot of kind of fringe elements. We should also say that it's not just about individual great powers. Sometimes you get coalitions of powers, and there's an entire class of middle powers that might be decisive in some of what we're talking about. So I would call Japan, South Korea, Australia. These are all powers that are in the middle, that are trying to figure out where their place is in this world, trying to create an order that is sustainable to let trade continue to function. And you'll see them kind of move in and out, and they can, I think, affect things going forward. So that's just a smattering of a couple that are on my radar. But yeah. I guarantee you there's one or two that not even the best geopolitical experts are thinking of that will come out of all of this. And probably there are one or two that will collapse that nobody was expecting to collapse.
Yeah. Let's dive into a bit of Russia and Ukraine. It just seems like people in general, war is very, of course, uncertain, and there's a lot of possible scenarios, but even just the current ramifications of this war are just so immense. It just seems like, you know, across the world, the impact is just being, you know, felt. For example, you know, in South Korea, they had presidential elections. Mm-hmm. You had a conservative party win, trying to align themselves more with the U.S. Also, in Japan, you had some of the government wanting to perhaps reconsider hosting nukes in Japan. People are kind of waking up. This Russia attack to Ukraine, can you kind of, from your perspective in the bigger picture, stepping back, let's say, you know, on a decade or multi-decade level, how big of a deal is this? Is this just like a small skirmish, or is this a really big kind of shakeup, or I won't say shakeup, but a poking of a global world order that could have huge ramifications of major change in the future?
I'm going to try and have my cake and eat it too, in that it's kind of both. Because the first reaction I have to your question is, it's a relatively small war at this point. Now, I don't mean that to dismiss the suffering of the Ukrainian people or of what's happening in Russia. For the people on the ground, this is actually a very big deal. And because Russia and Ukraine are such important food commodity exporters and energy exporters in the case of Russia, it's going to reverberate throughout the world. But keep in mind, this is two countries, and one is much stronger than the other. And Russia, if it can get out of its own way here, should prevail just in terms of numbers and firepower. There's no coalitions. There's no NATO. There's no multiple states on states. So in that sense, it's kind of a small conflict. What I do think is that it's unambiguously the end of that unipolar moment that we're talking about, and it's creating political reverberations throughout the world. It has fundamentally changed Europe, I think. If a couple weeks ago we had been talking about this German government throwing €1 billion into militarizing and boosting its defense spending to 2% of GDP as quickly as possible, people would have looked at you like you were crazy. And now it's literally happened before our eyes. And you've got the Europeans saying they're going to wean themselves off of Russian energy as quickly as they can and reduce it by 2/3 by the end of the year. That's a tremendous sea change. I'm glad you brought up the South Korean election. I actually just said to a client earlier today, it's the most important thing that happened this week that nobody's talking about because the headlines are all being soaked up by Russia and Ukraine, rightfully so. But that's a major change in South Korea's political orientation. It means a much more hawkish stance towards North Korea. It means that South Korea is going to be much more willing to cooperate with Japan and with the United States. It is bad for China, which had made significant inroads in Seoul over the past couple of years. So that's definitely something to kind of watch on the fringes too. And if you are, it's especially those Asian states. So whether you're Japan, South Korea, China, India, that are major exporters of energy, some of them are also major exporters of foodstuffs, for who this conflict really does hit home. For the United States, you know, the United States in some ways has been the toughest in terms of sanctions and in terms of trying to define the information war. But the United States is an energy superpower and it's an agricultural superpower. So yes, the price at the pump is going to go up and there's going to be probably a economic recession, even if Janet Yellen says there isn't going to be one. But for the United States, this is not existential. The United States can get through this on its own and has the resources to do so. For other countries that are dependent on some of these commodity flows, it's a picture of what an unmitigated disaster looks like. And if Russia can do something like this that nobody's expecting, you start trying to find other black swan events. And I think you see that in people throwing darts at the board saying, oh, will China do this about Taiwan? Is India going to try and push here? Is Iran? You start getting these sort of crazy scenarios that don't make sense. But I think that reflects a real fear about you know, suddenly there's a whole new set of possibilities that people didn't imagine happened before. So in that sense, yes, I think it's changed things irrevocably, and governments and countries and corporations are going to think about things much differently than they did before because of this invasion. But in terms of the actual war itself, it's fairly small. It just goes to show you that if you actually did have a much bigger conflict, just think about how much bigger the impact would be if it wasn't just two countries in Eastern Europe doing this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, well, on one side, you could say it's a small conflict, but if you look at it, not just from a military perspective, from, let's say, more of an economic war perspective with sanctions, etc., it's already escalated far beyond just two countries, you know, having huge impact in many global ways. Like, what's your perspective on kind of, you know, the economic warfare kind of aspect where, you know, you have the U.S., EU, you have other countries joining in, basically, you know, going very strong, aggressive, not just with sanctions, but, you know, cutting off some banks from SWIFT, cutting off the central bank, which is a hugely aggressive move. I mean, these are like fighting actions in some ways, like economically. Yeah, like, did this surprise you? I guess the level of kind of economic, you know, pushback that the world has done, or at least the West, you know, toward Russia.
It didn't surprise me in the sense that and Russia is a good example. If you looked at what the Russians have done since 2014, when the Ukraine crisis really began in earnest, they've been preparing for this ever since then. So they've been trying to build their own internal internet. They've been trying to wean themselves off the dollar. They've been building up their gold reserves. They've been trying to diversify their economy. So they knew that something like this was happening. The thing about, and this is what happens with conflicts, I think people tend to think that history happens sort of linearly, step by step over time. And that's not usually how it works. You actually get long periods of calm, and then everything happens within a short period, and then you kind of move on to another long period of calm. So everything's happening here in this small moment, but the table had been set. It's funny you mentioned the thing about sanctions. I was just reading a Peterson Institute paper that they came up with this figure that for the U.S. in particular, sanctions have only worked in 13% of the times they've applied them to actually get what they want out of a foreign policy perspective. And I think it's going to be the same here. And this is where I think we have to differentiate between some of the different types of sanctions, because the real sanctions that would be fighting words here would be if the Europeans said, we're not importing Russian natural gas and oil, and we don't care about the consequences for us. We're just going to shut it off. And we would rather the Russians not have the revenues from those energy exports than, you know, and we'll sacrifice the economic growth on top of it. Everything else around the sides, honestly, I don't think is as serious. Like, okay, so the U.S. bans Russian oil import. That's not existential for the United States. Economic actions become warfare when they threaten a country existentially. So the best example of this is that Japan makes the decision about Pearl Harbor when the United States puts an oil embargo on Japan in 1940. And that's when the Japanese realize, okay, we have to do something here. This is not tenable. Nobody's crossed any of those red lines quite yet. It's more about inflicting pain, trying to get people to do what you want to do, trying to get governments to respond. And if the measure of the effectiveness of sanctions and economic warfare is to change a nation's behavior, I mean, so far they've failed with Russia. Russia hasn't blinked once. And I think that's because Putin, for whatever we might say about his miscalculations, he knew all this was coming, and he assessed that the Russian economy could handle that. We'll see. I think that in the long term, this is going to be very damaging to Russia, but he seems to have been prepared. So that was a little bit of a rambling answer to your question, but the point I want to leave you with is that economic sanctions and things like this, it's not new. It's happened all the time. And none of what we've seen here is beyond the pale. It's just something that we haven't seen necessarily in the kind of the last 20 or 30 years.
Okay. So how about the freezing of the Russia's central bank assets overseas? That seems to be pretty severe. I mean, are those aren't fighting words in your opinion?
It was certainly severe. I don't think they're fighting words. If they were fighting words, we'd be fighting right now. Like, I mean, I think that I think it surprised the Russians, but they've also so far been able to get around it. I mean, and look at what's happened in Russia. The value of the ruble has been cut in half. The stock exchange has been closed forever. You've got lines outside of Russian banks and spontaneous protests, but Putin is still in charge. They're still prosecuting the war. They're still selling natural gas and oil to Europe and getting paid for it. They're finding buyers, albeit they're having to sell on the cheap for their wheat and things like that. I mean, sort of on the fringes, they're actually haltingly, and it's not efficient at all, but they're making it work. So again, I think Russia expected all of this kind of thing. It knows that it's in this kind of competition with the United States. It just wanted to rip off the Band-Aid, I think, and get something strategic out of it.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I would say on the flip side, it's only been 2 weeks, you know, mm-hmm. and the whole world is not going to fall apart in 2 weeks. Just, you know, freezing Russia's central bank assets are not going to cause the country to collapse immediately. But, you know, it looks like Russia could be headed for an imminent default on their foreign loans. And, you know, the inability for them to support the ruble can have some just rippling effects in the economy with trade. Already companies are not just pulling out, holding back because of the instability or volatility of the ruble. This is causing a lot of economic damage. Sure, Putin is still in charge, but, you know, this set of actions over a course of several months could perhaps, you know, really be, I guess, maybe not the entire, it's not the whole picture, but it's perhaps the start of something pretty severe or pretty big in Russia. I mean, what's your take? I'm just curious, like, it seems like you're taking the side that the central bank assets being frozen is not that big of a deal. But, I mean, this is a lot of money we're talking about, hundreds of billions of dollars. I mean, this seems to me like pretty severe stuff, but I'm just curious to hear your take.
Yeah, so I'm not saying it's not a big deal. It's a big deal. All I'm saying is that it's not fighting words. It's not something that Russia's going to start a war with NATO or with the United States about. It is certainly going to do severe damage to the Russian economy. If you're a creditor for Russia, I'm really sorry. You're up the creek without a paddle, as we used to say. It's going to reverberate throughout the world in that sense. I'm just saying that, you know, there are economic, and we can look back in history, there have been economic actions that actually led directly to war because they threatened a country existentially. And for Russia, like, it's not good to have the reserves cut off, and it's a sign of their weakness relative to the rest of the world that they're in this position. But it's going to be much more determinative what happens on the ground in Ukraine here in the next 2 or 3 weeks than it is that their reserves were frozen. And I think this actually gets to a really important point. I think the Russians expected this to be quick. And as I've said before, sure. if we get 2 to 3 weeks down the road, the pressure starts to shift from Kyiv to Moscow. And then Putin, as you're saying, really has to look in the mirror and say, okay, all of this damage that I've caused, and what was it for? Russian soldiers are dying, the economy has cracked, and I don't even have Kyiv to show for it. How is he supposed to answer to his own population, to the people behind him? And then I think you might see some real deleterious effects. So in that sense, it's kind of a race between the sanctions and Ukraine's ability to defend the capital and how fast Russian forces can move forward. So I don't mean to dismiss the gravity of the sanctions that restrict Russia's reserves. I'm just trying to say that in some ways, Russia wants this eventuality. It wants to decouple from the West. It wants to completely reorganize things so that it isn't so dependent on the West. In the past, when Russia's dealt with sanctions, they've said, we're fine with the sanctions. It forces us to do things that otherwise would have been politically untenable for us to insist, but now we can blame the West and try and gain self-sufficiency. It might still blow up in their face, but I think that's the thinking in Moscow.
Sure. I mean, one of the scenarios I think that might be on the table going forward is in a kind of not so good scenario, or let's say path. Obviously, there are good scenarios and not so good scenarios, but in a not so good scenario area, let's say the war drags out and the humanitarian cost is very severe. The US, EU steps up even more with sanctions. It seems like one of the logical steps would be to sanction those countries that are continuing to trade with Russia on items that the US has sanctioned. And that leads into this precarious position of what to do with China. And if the US starts to put down sanctions against China and their trade with Russia, and let's say China steps back and says, okay, fine, you know, we'll cut back trade on these items, all this stuff. Are these fighting words now? Because now, you know, Russia is in a sense, you know, has been relying more on the possibility of China being a bigger trading partner, kind of lessening this blow of, you know, being cut off from the West. But now if the West is going to cut off China, what's Russia's response, in that type of scenario, I think?
Yeah, now we're talking, because now we're talking about getting to the last remaining outlets that the Russian economy might have moving forward. There's been a lot of talk out of the United States about this week, especially from the U.S. Trade representative, and about how different sanctions might apply to China. And you've seen the reticence with China. There was that story about how they weren't going to send aircraft parts and things like that to Russia because they were afraid of sanctions. The reports about how much oil they're actually importing, it seems that they're actually a little trigger shy about importing that because they don't want to run afoul of the U.S. China doesn't want sanctions. China's very different from Russia in the sense that it really needs to work through its domestic economic problems right now. And the biggest threat to Xi and the Communist Party right now would be an economic collapse. If you had this kind of situation in the Chinese economy that's happening in the Russian economy right now, I would think that would be sort of an existential threat to the Chinese Communist Party and everything they're trying to put together. But it's not just China. So if you're going to play this game of whack-a-mole and you're going to cut off sort of the different countries that are importing from Russia or willing to trade with Russia, you're going to have to go after India, and you're going to have to go after Pakistan, and you're going to have to go after some of these sub-Saharan African countries that are dependent on grain imports from Russia. And that's a very difficult place to be in if you're the United States. How far do you want to push it? Are you just going to single China out and hope that that does it? Are you going to ruin your relationship with India because you're going to try and be much tougher on India than you have been, than say, in the context of Iran sanctions? It's a very difficult needle to thread there. And the more you push China, the more you actually continue to tear apart the world into these distinct spheres of influence and create a self-fulfilling prophecy where the United States world order gets smaller and smaller and smaller. So I guess what I'm trying to say is that I think that would actually be somewhat of a miscalculation from the United States. But you can't deny that that is the rhetoric we're hearing out of Washington right now, that China has been this sort of rallying cry for both parties for years now, and that even in the context of a Russia-Ukraine war, the U.S. is talking about how this affects China. And yes, and also to get back to your question, if you start cutting off those avenues for Russia, if you start completely isolating Russia, if you do increase those sanctions on Russian energy to where the Europeans are saying that, yes, then you're starting to put Russia into a desperate situation.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting you bring up this point of, the U.S. could potentially go, I won't say too far, but let's say they go to an extreme where, let's say they cut off or they sanction countries, trading with Russia, including China and others. We could run into a situation possibly of kind of the U.S. and the West creating, in a sense, an anti, West trading bloc, or kind of the beginnings of an alliance where, whereas before, perhaps the U.S. and the EU weren't seen perhaps as a belligerent state, maybe in, let's say, Southeast Asia or other places. But perhaps if this continues into deepening sanctions across more countries, it could divide up the world in ways that a year ago it would be unfathomable, in a sense, where, I don't know. It just seems like such a precarious situation where it could go, one way or the other. What's your gut take? I mean, do you think the U.S., if this war drags out, do you think they'll just ratchet up the sanctions? Do you think they'll just continue it, to go harder and harder, and it will spill over to other countries?
I'd sort of turn that question on its head and say this is also a reflection of what I was talking about the declining power of the United States relative to everyone else. The U.S. has basically fired its shot. I mean, yes, they can do some things with China, but the real actor here is Europe. If you saw Germany and France turning against Russia in the sense that they were going to put an oil and natural gas embargo on Russia, that's the sort of thing that I think would take this conflict to a different level. But the United States, unless it's going to go really hard after China and after Pakistan and India and try and use the playbook it's used on North Korea with Russia, unless it's going to go to that extreme, really what the United States probably should do in this moment is just kind of sit back and let Russia damage its reputation on the world stage and not help it at all, because all the countries that you're talking about in Southeast Asia, they don't want to have to pick sides.
Yeah.
They want to be able to trade with everyone. They want to trade with China. They want to trade with the United States. They don't want all of this kind of interference, and they will not feel good about the country that is the one that causes them all of these different problems. So in that sense, just let the Russians do what they're doing in Ukraine. Let the video come out of what they're doing. Let the Russians continue to isolate themselves, and then you can kind of work around that. It's already working to a certain extent on China. You know, day one, day two of this war, China was like, yes, we're going to import more Russian wheat. And yes, like, you know, this is for Russia and Ukraine to decide. We're going to stay out of it. But in the past week, you've been hearing things about Xi calling Putin and saying, no, maximum restraint. No, we need negotiations. The Chinese government's kept in touch with the Ukrainian government. There are reports they're not actually buying as much commodities as you think. So I think that's the, it's going to take some discipline from the United States to not kind of try and do a victory lap and do all these other different foreign policy initiatives that they might want to do and connect them to this Russia thing. Whereas really the thing to do here is take a step back, let Russia continue to do what it's doing, and let the world look at what Russia is doing and react accordingly. Because most countries, I think, will come to the U.S. position if Russia continues to do what it's doing in Ukraine.
Yeah, definitely. What's interesting is, love to hear feedback on this. It seems like Putin, this is speculation, of course, on my side of it. It seems like Putin maybe underestimated Biden's resolve in certain ways. Like, I think you look at Biden, what happened with Afghanistan, Biden's rhetoric, or his words on kind of not wanting to be involved militarily, you know, on the ground, not just in Afghanistan, but other places. And I think Putin could have misinterpreted that as like, oh, okay, we have a weak kind of US president who doesn't want to get involved. But what has surprised me a bit with Biden's response is his resolve on this issue to really just double down and really maximize, you know, his options in terms of sanctions, but not just sanctions, in terms of supporting Ukraine militarily in different ways, you know, just and it I don't know, what's your take on that, on this kind of the Biden response, you know, has that surprised you? Do you think that surprised Putin at all?
That's a great question, and nobody's quite asked me that way yet. The first thing I would say is that if Putin did underestimate Biden because of, say, Afghanistan, he made a big miscalculation, because Afghanistan was a demonstration of Biden's resolve. Remember, there have been multiple presidents from both parties who promised to end the war in Afghanistan. Donald Trump promised to do it. Barack Obama promised to do it. Neither one of them did it. Biden was the only one who was willing to take the hit to his popularity in the United States, which it did. His polls started to go down as a result of the Afghanistan issue and of withdrawing the way that it had. And there was no good way to withdraw from Afghanistan. I mean, it was going to blow up in your face no matter how well prepared you were. The United States obviously didn't do a great job preparing, but there was no ideal way to do this. And Biden said, no, the United States has to get out. The United States has to focus on Asia Pacific. So I think that was actually an example of his resolve. I also think, though, I doubt that the Russians thought that, because if you listen to what the Russians said about Biden, they respected him a lot. They thought he was a powerful president. They thought they might even be able to negotiate with him, and that because Biden had been so anti-Russia on the campaign trail, that Biden might actually have the sort of credentials that would allow him to compromise with the Russians, because he wouldn't have to be seen in Washington as somebody who was weak on Russia, because he was out there calling Putin a thug and saying that the United States relationship with Russia was not right. I do think the one thing that the Russians probably thought about Biden was that he was predictable. Donald Trump was not predictable. Somebody asked me at the very beginning of this conflict what would have happened in this conflict if Donald Trump had been president. And my answer was, well, I don't know. And the fact that I don't know and nobody knows probably would have caused the Russians to think twice about it. But I think they knew exactly how far Biden was willing to go, and more importantly, where he wasn't willing to go. And I think they also knew from Afghanistan there weren't going to be U.S. troops. This wasn't going to be a NATO fight. Yes, they might supply them some weapons, but you know, it's not going to be anything that's going to decide the conflict. And this was the other part, I think, of the Russian miscalculation. I think Moscow thought this was going to be a quick fight.
Yeah.
And I can't explain why Russia thought that, but I think they thought they were going to wrap this up in a couple of weeks' time, and you weren't going to get to the point where Biden was going to be out there having the platform to say all this, that it was instead going to be a sort of 2008 Georgia scenario where it was an embarrassment, where the United States had built up Ukraine for so long, and ultimately it wasn't good for Ukraine and they didn't do very well. But just in terms of Biden itself, no, I think that Russia understood who Biden was and understood where he wasn't willing to go. And that's probably why they felt willing to take the calculated risk to move into Ukraine.
Yeah. I mean, do you think though, I guess, you know, thinking about this stuff in retrospect is, you know, is bliss in a sense, but like, it seems like if Biden would have been a bit more stronger or a lot more stronger saying that if you invade Ukraine, we are going to supply weapons, unending, you know, for Ukraine to defend themselves. And we are going to be very involved in this war, not with troops, but with sanctions, with just rallying the world, with, you know, just military support, all this stuff, that perhaps Putin would have thought a little bit harder about, you know, his calculus to invade. Because it seems like the Russian or the Putin equation is, okay, the U.S. is signaling that they're not going to get involved troop-wise, militarily-wise, and that they will, you know, push sanctions, you know, and accordingly to how much, you know, damage or things are done on the Russian side. But in Putin's calculus, he's like, well, I'll take that, you know? I mean, I can handle the sanctions, and I could get this job done quickly, get a regime change done, you know, in a few weeks or a month or something. But if Biden would have been a lot more clearer with, like, his, like, the scenario of a full-blown attack, you know, taking out these cities, do you think that would have changed the equation at all for Putin?
No. The only thing that would have deterred Putin were things that Biden was probably both unwilling and politically incapable of doing. I've been quoting what the Russian ambassador to Sweden said in the lead up to the war, which was he was asked, you know, are sanctions going to deter Russia from defending its national security? And I'm quoting him. He said, Russia doesn't give a shit about the sanctions. I mean, that's literally, I think, what they think in Moscow. The only way you were going to deter Russia was if it was an ironclad defense commitment. So I think that's one of the reasons why you see Russia, you know, making threats and putting things out about Poland in the media, but Poland has a U.S. security guarantee. I think Russia knows not to mess around with Poland because that would get them into a fight with the United States that they absolutely can't win. No matter what the United States said about Ukraine, and Biden was actually pretty clear that he was not for this and that this was bad and that there were going to be economic sanctions, you know, crippling economic sanctions from the United States if Russia did this. None of that scared Russia. I think the difficult truth for a lot of folks in the West is if you wanted to defend Ukraine, that meant soldiers, that meant people dying, that meant billions of dollars in terms of actually, you know, weapons that you could send there, teach the Ukrainians how to use. Like, that's the type of deterrence that would have prevented Russia from doing something. The ironic and, you know, the flip side of all of this, of course, is that might have triggered Russia to act anyway, because that's what Russia said they were exactly afraid of. So I'm not blaming anyone here. I understand why the United States wanted that strategic ambiguity. And that strategic ambiguity is why this conflict is happening. Ukraine matters more to Russia than it matters to anybody else. And so in just that limited sense, Russia was going to be the one to make the move, and Russia's probably going to be the one that sticks around there. At the bigger strategic level, I think it's a disaster for Russia. But just in that very small way, it mattered more to Russia, so Russia was going to push forward. I think that is the very limited sense in which it's similar to the Taiwan conflict with between China and Taiwan. Mm-hmm. Taiwan matters more to China than it matters to anybody else. So China's going to organize its entire foreign policy around making sure that eventually it's going to reabsorb Taiwan one day. I don't care how much Washington says it supports Taiwan, I can guarantee you it's not going to be the top issue for the United States, no matter how much they talk about it.
So. Mm-hmm. Sure. So one kind of idea I was thinking about is this Russia invasion war against Ukraine. Do you think it'll spark militarization across the world? And if so, like in what areas or what countries do you think, you know, it would kind of influence the most? And the reason why I ask that question is because it just seems like this invasion is such a dramatic case where Ukraine isn't a tiny, tiny country. You know, it isn't just like a million people or something, you know, a small piece of land. This is a large country in Europe. And for Russia to do this kind of unilateral just move against global opinion generally, and to do it in a way in which they're doing it, you know, with civilian casualties and all this stuff, it just seems like it's a wake-up call for a lot of countries that maybe don't take their military very seriously. You know, they're like, you know, we live in a peaceful world, the most peaceful era in, you know, human history, all sorts of this, right? kind of thinking, you know, blissfully on the 20th century, but we live in perhaps a different reality, a different world right now that Russia is perhaps kind of shining light on, which is a much more precarious situation, where maybe this whole, you know, era, post-World War II era of peace and kind of, you know, of is not the norm. I mean, what's your take on this, the future of militarization? Do you think this is a real, you know, trend going forward? And how do you kind of wrap your head around that?
Yeah, there's two questions on there. The first answer to your question about whether this is an era of militarization, absolutely 100% yes, and we've already seen it. I mean, I already mentioned Germany, 100 billion euros into militarizing over the next 2 years, but it's not just Germany. Poland says they're going to double the size of their army and increase defense spending to 2 to 3% of GDP. Even Denmark is saying that it's going to, not only is it going to increase military spending, the Danes said they're going to allow budget deficits after 2025 just to fund militarization of their country. Sweden, I think, made a lot of headlines this week because they said they didn't want to join NATO because they didn't want to upset Russia too much. But they also announced a major military spending package. It's also not just Europe. I read a great article from an Indian think tank. I'm forgetting the exact name today. Maybe I can send you the link afterwards, about what India should learn from this conflict. And it was a very thoughtful consideration, actually, of how the Indian military has made a lot of strides, but it doesn't have good coordination between its air force and its ground forces, which is exactly what Russia is experiencing now. And it talked about how maybe India should learn from all of Russia's mistakes right now, so that if it gets into a conflict later on, it can do what it needs to do. Japan has been very quietly militarizing here for a couple different years, and I think you're already seeing this conflict also grow into that. So we haven't even mentioned the U.S. deal with Australia about submarine technology and how that was a big kerfuffle. So absolutely, it's an era of militarization. It's also, like most industries, even sort of even weapons and military industrial complex is a globalized industry. And I think that's also going to change a little bit, because you can't have these globalized supply chains if you're also dealing with this level of geopolitical competition. So Europe's going to have its own supply chains for weapons and fighter jets and artillery, and India's going to have its own, and China's going to have its own. A lot of industries are going to be restricted this way, but the defense industry, more than any others, you're going to see this reshoring or nearshoring to places that are politically reliable. I'd also just say I've never understood this argument that we live in the most peaceful time in human history, because it didn't feel very peaceful to someone like me who, you know, thinks about geopolitics all the time. It's true that there were no great sort of state-to-state wars happening in the world, and that's because the United States was the dominant power. So if you were going to get into a conflict, the United States was going to come in, and it wasn't going to go very well. But think about some of the things that have happened in the last 20 to 30 years. The rise of ISIS in the Middle East, the Syrian civil war was an incredibly bloody, awful conflict. The Balkan Wars in the early and late 90s, you know, people talk about Europe hasn't seen this type of violence in a generation. I was alive when NATO went into bombing Serbia and everything that happened in that conflict. Think about the genocides in Rwanda, in Sudan. Like, there are so many conflicts that have been bubbling underneath the surface. And just because they haven't sort of gotten on the West radar, or because they haven't been sort of these big wars that we learn about in history books, that doesn't mean the world's been peaceful. The world has actually been just as violent as usual. It's just that the extent to which those conflicts could become international conflicts was much smaller than before. That's what's changed right now. These conflicts are not going to be localized or isolated. You're not going to have one country that's going to tamp down on them, and you're going to have lots of other countries that are probably taking advantage or trying to take stock. Which goes right to your point about militarization and being ready for these types of things going forward.
Yeah, I mean, if you combine some of these things of, you know, let's say a multipolar world, a world moving toward more militarization, and there's a bigger backdrop perhaps of cultural differences, religious differences, worldview differences that, you know, I'm sure you, having a background with the Middle East, like, it's just different worlds, you know, of value systems. And I mean, what's your take? Does this lead to increased chances, probabilities of bigger conflicts in the future, including, you know, wars that include multiple parties, multiple countries, world wars? Are we looking at, you know, another world war in the next, let's say, 10 or 15 years?
Yeah. So On the culture point, and this might be a blind spot of geopolitics, I'm not sure. I think about this a lot when I'm drinking wine on the weekends. Because for geopolitics, all of those things are second order. It's not that ideology and religion and culture aren't important, but it really is to say that geography and the things that nations need in order to survive and to assert themselves are actually what create culture and what create religion. And that oftentimes conflict is justified in the language of ideology to sell it to a population or to a government, but that's not actually what's like, it's not culture that is actually moving the conflict. Samuel Huntington is the sort of U.S. political science scholar who came up with this idea of clash of civilizations, where he thought we were going to get all these different cultural civilizations that didn't want to mix with each other, and that the clash was going to be along civilizational grounds. That may end up being what it looks like in the end, but I don't think that's the driving force. For me, and as a geopolitical analyst, I'm looking at things like geography. I'm looking at, okay, what does this nation need in order to survive? And then how is it going to go pursue it? And how's it going to justify it in whatever religious or cultural or ideological language that it needs to? In terms of the world war question, I already spoke to you a little about the mental map to have in mind is the 1890s. So it's been a pretty doom and gloom discussion so far. Let me give you a little bit of optimism. The 1890s was a great time. It was La Belle Epoque. It was so much art and so much trade. And we had an agricultural revolution and an industrial revolution. And all that's happening right now. We're going through another industrial revolution. We're going to have artificial intelligence. We're going to have 5G. And we're going to have all of these things that I think are going to increase productivity and increase efficiency. I think we're probably living on the cusp of another agricultural revolution, too, as you apply some of that technology so that you can really precisely deploy fertilizer, or so that you can grow crops on much less water than you might otherwise, because you have more insight about when exactly they need water and all these other sorts of things. So like I said, I don't think we're at the World War III scenario quite yet. I think we're in that messy before time in the 1890s and 1900s, where yes, you've got global competition, yes, you've got violence, but there's no one country or group of countries that is going to be any stronger than the others. Nobody's going to be able to claim supremacy. And for a while, at least, I think that will reduce the chances of war, because nobody will think they could win in that kind of war. That's the other thing about war. Wars only get fought by countries that think that they can win. So Russia went into Ukraine because they assessed that they could win. And that's a realistic assessment from somebody like me or even an external observer. There's nobody right now who, you know, let's just throw out U.S. and China as examples. I'm not saying this is going to happen. There is nobody in the U.S. who thinks that the U.S. can win a war against China. And there's probably nobody in China who thinks that China can win a war against the U.S. That scale has to flip before you can get into the sort of systemic conflict you're talking about. If we go 20 years in this direction and we don't take any of the off-ramps and we don't find pragmatic ways of building order or setting red lines or understanding what everyone's interests are, then yes, you could absolutely get that kind of cataclysmic international war scenario. It's not yet set in stone. And the other sort of, maybe this is too optimistic or idealistic of me, is that we also have some pretty big problems in the world as a species that might outweigh some of these more provincial problems. Climate change is the number one thing. What if climate change accelerates in a way that causes all types of economic destruction and you get more natural disasters in a lot quicker fashion than most are expecting? Maybe then you'll have the kind of conditions you would need for more cooperation between nations and understanding that all of these conflicts have to be put on ice because we've got bigger problems. So I don't think World War III is set in stone. If it's going to happen, it's going to happen 15 or 20 years from now. And right now in this period, it's just going to be a lot of instability, a lot of, like I said, shifting relationship over time. Don't think anything is going to be set in stone.
Mm-hmm. So from that perspective, would it be too far to assume that you're pretty optimistic in terms of how this Ukraine-Russia war ends up, like not escalating, you know, to a world war, finding some type of resolution in the near future? I mean, what's your take on kind of how this Ukraine war ends up?
Yeah, I wouldn't call myself optimistic about it because I think it's going to be terrible, especially for the Ukrainians. I don't think it's going to go beyond Russia and Ukraine. I should say one of the reasons strategists like me don't like war is because war is inherently unpredictable. And all it takes is one errant missile falling on the wrong side of a border to set something off. we got an example of that just this week. I don't know if you saw this report that the Indians accidentally somehow fired a missile that landed in Pakistan, which like scared the crap out of me for 24 hours yesterday when I was trying to figure out what happened. So you can have things like that that happen in the fog of war that can escalate. And that's always a possible scenario, but I think it's the least likely scenario. I think this is going to be confined to Russia and Ukraine. I say that I'm pessimistic about the war, though, because if you look at what Russia has done, excuse me, in these types of conflicts, whether it was in Syria or Grozny and Chechnya, it basically just grinds its enemies down, and it doesn't care about civilians, and it levels cities, and it's going to be really awful. And unfortunately, when you just look at the numbers that Russia has, the firepower that it has, the way that it's coiling to try and actually achieve its military objectives in Ukraine, I think that's what we're heading to. And I don't think Ukraine's going to give up. So then you're going to see probably an insurgency in Ukraine for years going forward, because they're going to resist Russia going forward and anyone who's going to collaborate with them. The really optimistic scenario would be if the Ukrainians 2 weeks from now are still blocking the Russians from going into Kyiv and are still preventing them from reaching their military objectives. And we've seen little hints, you know, Russia was dropping this week, hey, if Ukraine just, if it enshrines neutrality in its constitution, if it recognizes Donetsk and Luhansk as independent and it says Crimea is Russian, we're ready to talk. Like that was a little trial balloon from the Russians, I think, trying to start laying out what is the framework of a deal if things don't go well for them and they have to try and make a deal and sell a victory to their own people. That's what you're banking on if you're optimistic, that the Ukrainians can hold out for another 2 or 3 weeks, make this really bloody for the Russian military to where Russia feels like it has to compromise. I think that's possible. But I like I said, I think the more likely scenario is that the images and footage we're going to see out of Ukraine in the next 2 or 3 weeks is going to be increasingly grisly. The Russian advantages are going to assert themselves, and it's going to be this low-level insurgency, frozen conflict for this foreseeable future.
How long do you think this could go on?
It could go on for a long time, but if it goes on much more than a month or two, it's going to be really bad for it's going to be bad for Russia no matter what happens. Let me be clear. But if this active kinetic phase of the conflict goes on for another month or two, I don't know how long Putin has to stay in office. I don't see him surviving as president if this goes a month or two longer than it has. But in terms of the Russia-Ukraine issue itself, I mean, gosh, that's been going on for centuries and will probably continue to go on for centuries. And like I said, Ukraine is not Belarus. It's not Kazakhstan. The Russians are not just going to go in, install their own leader, go home, and everything's going to be fine. The one thing we've learned about the Ukrainians in the last couple of weeks, and I think it's to the surprise of Russian intelligence, but also to the United States, I don't think anybody knew just how fiercely and how proudly the Ukrainians were going to resist. And that tells me that even if Russia gets to Kyiv and installs its own government, Ukrainians are not going to take this line down. They'll move to guerrilla warfare or insurgency or whatever they have to, because they don't want to live under Russian authoritarian rule.
Yeah. I mean, that brings up, the point where, if you look at it from this angle where if Putin would have kind of finished the job quickly, you know, within a couple of weeks, then it was his best chance of achieving his objectives. You know, if there was, the less we saw of casualties, of civilian casualties, of damage, all this stuff, it would be a easier pill to swallow for Ukraine to have a settlement. But now you've got this situation where you have just massive destruction, devastation. You have not just that, you have, the real lives of people on the ground who they all know each other, whose family members have died, pregnant, woman that they know, or this, child trying to escape, and all of these stories that are now part of Ukrainian history that in a way create an anti-objective for Putin, meaning it's like the opposite of what he wanted. You know, he wanted a neutral Ukraine, but he's gotten almost like he's almost ensured an anti-Russia Ukraine now, with all the devastation he's done. And with an anti-Russia Ukraine, the natural kind of movement, it seems, would be toward the EU, away from Russia over time. Sure, there might be some military like neutrality agreements or security agreements, by other countries, etc. But how do you not see a Ukraine that's going to be wanting to move, more toward Europe? And what's your take kind of on the future of Ukraine in that sense?
I think you're exactly right. I mean, Putin has ensured that a generation of Ukrainians will grow up seeing Russia as the enemy. And that's what's been so hard to comprehend, because what Putin is doing in Ukraine, it doesn't really make sense. It makes sense if you abstract everything and you're just pushing pins around on a map and saying, aha, I will rebuild, you know, the ancient Russian lands and I will be the leader who united Russia. But that's just not going to work. Unfortunately for Ukraine, I mean, I think that, again, I think Russia has the dominant force there. Nobody's going to help Ukraine. So you'll see outsiders give them arms and they'll try and foment an insurgency to the extent that they can. But I don't think the EU is necessarily going to let Ukraine in. Certainly NATO is not. But for those countries in the EU and NATO, it's going to make them much stronger and have much more resolve in resisting Russia going forward. No European country is going to believe a word out of a Russian leader's mouth for decades going forward. Because, and this is, again, the other part, it's not just the suffering and the images that we've seen with the civilian strikes that Russia's been undertaking in Ukraine. This really goes to the effectiveness of the Zelensky government and how important personal leadership can be in these types of conflicts. Zelensky has done incredibly well, and he's done incredibly well because Ukraine's won the information war on this from the very beginning. From the very beginning, you know, Zelensky going out into the streets, taking Instagram videos of himself and saying glory to Ukraine, you know, being there with his people and giving people this face and this idea that there is resistance, that was really, really powerful. And I think that was another one of the things that Russia didn't quite get. The Russia information war was really bad. I mean, think about what Russia was trying to sell to the world. They were trying to say that the Ukrainians were a bunch of fascists and Nazis, and that the Russians had to go in to denazify and demilitarize the government. It's just like, it's not even close. Like, usually propaganda is effective when it sort of has half truths in it. That's not even like 1/10 true. It was just completely out of wholesale cloth, and they thought everybody was going to buy it. And by creating such a flimsy justification for war, like you said, they gave Ukraine the victory in the information war in the start, and now Russia's actions to try and achieve victory are just going to increase the resolve of EU and NATO against Russia in the future and make Ukraine a hot, not just a neutral, a hostile country to Russian interests mm-hmm. going forward.
Yeah. I mean, it's originally I was thinking it's kind of mind-boggling how inept, like,
security influence with Hong Kong over time to the point that it was a fait accompli. So when the British in the 1980s went and said, hey, we'd like to renew our 99-year lease of Hong Kong, is that cool? The Chinese said, absolutely not. And it was Margaret Thatcher who was prime minister at the time, you know, the uber sort of nationalist who wanted to put Britain back on the global stage. And, you know, she said, well, I want Hong Kong. And the Chinese simply said, well, we'll turn off all the water and we'll turn off all the electricity and we'll blockade it. And if you want it, you can go in and fight for it if you want. Or are you prepared to do that? And Thatcher said, okay, like, you got me. I don't have the capability to do this and let it go. That's the playbook I think that China's using with Taiwan. It is isolating it politically. The move towards self-sufficiency in some of these supply chains is going to render Taiwan's semiconductor advantage probably moot in the next 5 or 10 years. So people are going to care about it less economically. And from a security perspective, they are building up their forces so that when they make the threat, it's not just, you know, them. It's a real threat that they can actually follow through on. I expect that what they want is that kind of political fait accompli. Now, the way, I guess, that, you know, get away from my hot take answer about the Russia-Ukraine thing. Mm-hmm. If it did come to that, and if China made a similar miscalculation with Taiwan as Russia has made with Ukraine and decided that military force was the way to get reunification with Taiwan, yes, I think you would see U.S. companies probably leave in droves. That would be a much broader conflict, I think, and it would be much more serious with the global economy. It also, over the next 5 to 10 years here, you're going to see more, because U.S. companies are already leaving China. I work with clients all the time who are saying, and it's not for any political reason. Sometimes it's just, hey, labor costs in China are way up. I would like to decrease my labor costs. Where am I going to go? Or I don't want to be in this particular geography because of risk or because of where my customers are. I'd like to get a little bit closer to my customers. So it's not all kind of political ideology. But the point is, American companies are already leaving China. And China is the one that wants to leverage its own domestic market for its companies. So it's happy to have Western companies in there now. But as it ascends the value chain and as it gets better from a technology perspective, it's going to be supporting its own national champions. Now, I don't think that's going to happen in the way that it happens in Russia. I think that it's going to be sort of softer ways where they're going to impose restrictions that make it harder for foreign companies to make profits once you have Chinese national champions that are able to take over. But this, again, gets back to capabilities. China still doesn't have the ability to manufacture and make some of the things you need to function in the global economy. So when you listen to Xi and look at Chinese policy, they want to trade more. They want to be open. Everybody freaks out about these Chinese regulatory moves towards tech companies. That's exactly what people have wanted for 15 years. Real clear rules that are actually enforced. That's what they're trying to do. They're trying to encourage people that their market is a little more stable and a little more predictable. So maybe when we get down the road and we get towards World War III scenarios, you get the type of thing you're talking about. But I don't see that happening in the next couple of years. I actually think in that sort of 1890s scenario that I've talked to you about, this is the great example where there's going to be risks in China, no doubt. There's going to be a lot of ideological froth and scary headlines, but also a lot of money to be made, both by Chinese companies and U.S. companies and all sorts of other types of companies there. So it's not going to be a comfortable place to be, but I think it's going to be a place to be. I don't think you're about to erect a great wall around China and nobody's going to want to be there.
Sure. I mean, Taiwan is a tricky one because, like, with Hong Kong, you had this kind of looming, 99-year, agreement that was ending, and it was kind of like supposed to go back to China anyways type of, situation. But with Taiwan, you don't have this like looming agreement that it's going back to China, and you have some kind of fierce, anti-China sentiment in Taiwan, a growing kind of national identity, and the U.S. up until now doubling down their support, on Taiwan. And it just seems like, I don't know how long this can last as China, grows in power and influence. Do they really want, Taiwan to be so closely aligned with the U.S. and the West right off their border, right off their coast? Is there a time where China tries to resolve this? I don't know. How do you think this situation resolves? Because, Hong Kong, it seems like it was something that China was expecting to be resolved in some way. But I don't know, Taiwan, it doesn't seem to be a similar, like, clear path, of resolution. What's your take on some, possible scenarios of resolution there?
It's a more complicated path, but I think China expects Taiwan, just like Hong Kong, that it will eventually be part of China again. I mean, I think that's the kind of expectation. To your point, though, I mean, yes, the U.S. in some ways has a close relationship with Taiwan, but it's not that close. They don't recognize them as an independent country. They're not going to be part of a U.S. military alliance. You can't even sign a treaty with Taiwan because, as I said, Washington doesn't even recognize them as a country. Remember, the whole reason we're in this position is because the U.S. felt a relationship with China in the context of the Cold War in the 70s was more important than recognizing Taiwan. We were talking about the Russia-Ukraine war to understand what's going to happen next year. The Korean War is really the war to study if you want to understand what this looks like if it goes hot, because that was South Korea at the time was really a place where the U.S. even said that it wasn't a national security interest for it. Dean Acheson, the U.S. Secretary of State, famously made a speech at the National Press Club in Washington and left South Korea out of the defined U.S. security perimeter. And if you believe the Soviets, that's the moment that they decided to push the North Koreans to invade because they didn't think that the Americans were going to come to the rescue there. But again, in some ways, it's also the wrong conflict because it started with the Soviet Union. It didn't start with anything that China did in that sense. I think the thing that is more worrying for China, I mean, if the United States is going to start arming Taiwan with Patriot missiles or recognize them as a country, yes, this is going to become a hot conflict. China's going to intervene. I don't think the U.S. has the kind of appetite for this. But I think you actually alluded to the scenario that's more scary, which is that, and this is being proven out in polls in Taiwan, it seems that a Taiwanese national identity is emerging. And it seems that fewer and fewer Taiwanese people either identify as Chinese or identify as both, that there seems to be some kind of coherent Taiwanese narrative coming through, and that the way that China dealt with Hong Kong recently in terms of getting rid of two systems, we saw a spike there in Taiwanese identity really cohering. So there's two ways to think about that. The first is that that will make China nervous and that they will make a Russia-style decision to go in there before they've really lost the whole game. But the other side of that is that maybe China just understands that this is a long game, and that by actually, and you said this yourself earlier in our conversation, if China did to Taiwan what Russia's doing to Ukraine, all it's doing is completing Taiwan's complete and total hatred of China going forward. You would just create a generation of Taiwanese people who really don't like you at all. So in some ways, what China has to do, I think, here in the next couple of decades, and I think that's the frame that they're thinking on, is how do we tie the Taiwanese economy closer to our economy? How do we make sure that it is in Taiwan's interest to be more aligned with us? How do we make it so that the opportunity cost of intervention here is too high for powers outside of this region to actually care that much? Those, I think, are the types of decisions that China is going to be making. And then, you know, lastly, again, this is also a different conversation once China feels like it has the military capability to do something. I'm operating from the analytical premise that I don't see that China can do anything right now, and it's going to be years before it has the military capability to even consider this. It's a different set of calculations once China actually has the requisite military force, and then maybe things change a little bit. But for now, that's where I sit. I'm more concerned about China and the Philippines having some kind of dust up as a Chinese test for how much the U.S. is really going to come intervene in, with a U.S. security ally in the region, than I am in terms of China doing anything with Taiwan in the next 5 to 10 years.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. What are your thoughts on North Korea and South Korea? Like with China, you know, you have a U.S. military presence, you know, I think tens of thousands of troops in South Korea right next to you, very, very mm-hmm. close to you, your major cities, you know, and how long will China tolerate that for? But then again, you have, you know, Japan and next lives right next to China too. They've got bad blood, and they might be, you know, obviously rethinking, you know, their military kind of position as well. But I mean, that whole peninsula is fascinating. How long do you think North Korea can last, and what happens, do you think? Of course, no one knows for sure. I mean, who would have thought, you know, 10, 15 years ago, even 20 years ago? Actually, hold on 1 second. Yeah, so I mean, going back to what we're talking about, yeah, who would have thought like 10, 15, 20 years ago that North Korea would still be around in its, you know, almost, I don't say identical state, but you've got the regime intact, you know, in the middle of these, you know, Russia, China, South Korea, Japan, and somehow, you know, still a viable state. How long can this go? Can this continue?
Yeah, I love these geopolitical anachronisms that sort of exist out of time in the global system. There's a couple of them. North Korea's in there. Cuba is another one. Iran, I think, is also another one. All of that's kind of left over from the Cold War stuff. So I'm endlessly fascinated by those types of things. My first rule of analysis when it comes to North Korea is nobody has any clue. And so don't trust anybody that says they do. I have no idea what the timeline is. I can tell you, though, a couple things about geopolitics of the Korean Peninsula. The first is, in general, Korea throughout its history has looked towards China, not towards the Pacific, not towards Japan. You alluded to the bad blood between Japan and Korea. It's very, very real. The Japanese have invaded the Korean Peninsula multiple times. They were very not nice to be charitable to them when they did it. And the Koreans remember that. And a lot of Korean culture in the past, you know, in the last hundreds of years, it's generally admired what's going on in China. So in some ways, you have a very artificial setup in the Korean Peninsula. I don't know when it's going to happen. If you told me it happened in 5 years, I wouldn't be surprised. If you told me it happened in 100 years, I wouldn't be surprised. Eventually, the Korean Peninsula will unify. And at that moment, I think it's a West-East Germany sort of thing. And I think Korea has incredible potential at that point, because if South Korea can reintegrate North Korea, it's like reintegrating a frontier economy into your own economy and powering your way through in a way that nobody else could. And in general, Korea's geopolitical position lends it to not actually aligning with any one power. It's the shrimp among whales. It wants to make sure that it doesn't get crushed between everyone. It wants to kind of play all sides. So that's how the Korean Peninsula works when it's unified. It's not, to your point. So you have this weird sort of artificial construction where China uses North Korea for its geopolitical aims. Japan and the United States want to use South Korea for its claims, but South Korea also has its own imperatives. And South Korea has done a very good job for itself. In some ways, South Korea is the biggest winner of this whole supply chain issue, because they are the only other ones besides the Taiwanese who even have a chance at making some of these advanced semiconductor chips and being such a crucial part of global supply chains when it comes to technology. So no idea when it happens, but eventually eventually I think the Korean Peninsula is unified and is probably more independent-minded than either Beijing or Washington would hope or want.
Yeah, that's interesting. And then on China, so we've talked about China back and forth, you know, during this conversation. You know, there's a growing kind of narrative in the West of China become as an enemy of the U.S. You have this, you know, just growing rhetoric on media and different, even not just media, you have lots of places, think tanks, et cetera. Of course, there's opposing sides, but there is seems to be a growing opinion that the U.S. and China are enemies, are, you know, going at it. It's a destiny to, the future is, you know, U.S.-China conflict. Do you agree with that narrative? And, you know, if so, why? Or if not, why?
Let me attack that from a couple levels. First, I don't view China as an enemy personally. And I would view it as an incredible catastrophe if in my lifetime or if in my children's lifetime we're fighting China. I don't want my kids to be fighting a war against China. I think that would be monumentally stupid. That's my personal bias, whatever you want to call it. That's kind of my personal view. It is undeniable that public opinion on both sides has hardened against each other. And the most distressing thing in the past couple of years, it was always kind of hard against each other in the older generations because they remembered the Cold War, and it's just kind of hard to get over those preconceived notions or prejudices, if you will. But until really the Trump administration, on both sides, in both the United States and China, both polls showed that young Americans liked the Chinese and young Chinese liked the Americans, and that there were things that both admired in each other, and they didn't think in terms of these old ossified geopolitical conflicts. Unfortunately, those poll numbers have gone the wrong direction the last couple of years, and there's been a hardening of opinion on both sides based on the polls that I have seen. And certainly within the U.S. political establishment, before this Russia-Ukraine stuff, it seemed to be that the only thing that Republicans and Democrats could agree on was that China was bad. I mean, in some ways, the U.S. election came down to which president saying he was going to be tougher on China. And you've seen that in practice. I mean, things have actually gotten worse, I think, in terms of U.S.-China relations under the Biden administration than the Trump administration. I mean, they've been better in that they've been more predictable. But in terms of the actual relations, I mean, the United States has not lifted any of the Trump-era tariffs. It's actually doubling down on some of them and trying to make them more effective to hurt the Chinese economy more to get, not exactly sure what the goal or objective is. I think there is an element of this, you know, it's Graham Allison's famous book about the Thucydides trap, where the rising power and the falling power are destined to meet each other in battle. I don't think that that's destiny, but I would tell you that the off-ramps are disappearing. So there are opportunities, I think, for the U.S. and China to get away from the path that they're on. But, you know, kind of each year that we hurtle towards this and every bit of hostile rhetoric from both the United States and China towards each other, each time, you know, the other side demonizes the other or is not willing to cooperate or be open with the other, we just kind of get further down that path. So, like I said, I think there are actually still scenarios in which China and the United States can cooperate. A really tangible example was that Iran nuclear deal example we talked about. If the human species is going to deal with climate change in a meaningful way, it's going to be because China and the United States get on the same page and think more about human beings than they do about national rivalries. But there's not a whole lot in human history to say that that's what's going to happen. And certainly the current trend is fairly depressing, to put it.
Yeah. I mean, where does all this hostile rhetoric come from? Let's say on the U.S. side, you know, against China, you're talking about it spans both, you know, sides of the aisle. Generally, like, where's the source of all this?
I think it comes from a couple of different areas, and it's actually, if you go back and look at U.S. opinion on China going back over a century, it's always kind of been there. And I think part of it is that the U.S. accurately sees in China the one real threat in the world to it. Think about every major power the United States has gone up against in sort of the last 150 years. Germany was much smaller than the United States. Soviet Union was ultimately a paper tiger. I mean, it looked good on paper, but its economy was much less sophisticated. It didn't have the kind of cultural appeal in the rest of the world. It certainly didn't have the type of power that it would have needed to project outwards. China's different. China has more people than the United States. China has access to the sea. China makes a lot of the things that the Americans have always made. In some ways, China has just followed the American playbook to becoming a rising power. They attracted all this manufacturing. They did all these things and became a center of the global economy. So I think part of it is that the United States sees a version of itself in China and wants China to behave the way the United States would want to, but doesn't see China for the way that it is. And I'm sure that that cuts both ways. I don't mean to say that this is just kind of an American problem. The second problem is again, we've got hangovers here from the Cold War. The Chinese Communist Party, it's communist in name. I mean, when Xi Jinping is talking about supply side reforms and things that are more at home in a Ronald Reagan speech than in the Communist Manifesto, I always laugh because people think China's it's communist in form. When you actually look at what China is, it's not. It's some kind of weird authoritarian capitalism. It's kind of a strange system, right? But we're talking about the American psyche. And in the American psyche, I think they see China as, no, they're communist. No, they resist liberal democracy. We are individualistic. They are communalistic. We want human rights. They care more about the greater good. You sort of set up all these tropes. And I think that's really taken hold in a way. So I think those are some of the reasons that the ideological that the United States government can use, can go back to that ideological well over and over again, because it plays on American fears. There's a ready set narrative there in Americans' heads that China is resisting or is not good. And if they could just embrace democracy, you know, everything would be fine. So I can't speak too much to the Chinese psyche, although I would bet that from their point of view, the United States is just one of several imperial powers that was happy to take advantage of China when it was down on its luck. And now that China's a rising power, the United States wants China to play by U.S. rules. And China's saying, well, we don't want to play by U.S. rules. Those rules were pretty bad for us for most of the last 150 years. Haven't we done our part? Haven't we earned a seat at the table? Why aren't we being respected as an equal? We're more powerful than France and the UK and Russia and all these other folks. Like, why can't you deal with us on an equal basis and respect our national sovereignty? We respect yours. So, I mean, that's just my guess at sort of how the Chinese psyche is, but there definitely is a mutual unintelligibility building there, unfortunately.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it seems, yeah, it is concerning actually to me. The hostile rhetoric as you say, makes me think of the idea of the role of propaganda in forming, shaping, perhaps even causing, geopolitical conflict. Have you thought about kind of the role of social media, of propaganda domestically to shape agenda, to shape narratives, to place blame on, you know, certain parties or foreign powers, et cetera, and that having an outsized impact on the outcome of geopolitical events? And I guess another question along those lines are, has the internet fundamentally changed geopolitics due to how geopolitical events are influenced by propaganda, which is influenced by the internet? And like, does that change the future of how geopolitical events take place going forward versus how they've kind of taken place in the past?
I wrestle with this question a lot, because I think it's too flippant to say that the internet and social media haven't changed anything. But on the other hand, we've had newspapers and media and, you know, thought development and communication with each other for hundreds of years. So yes, it's more instantaneous. Yes, you can see people's faces. Maybe there are ways you can manipulate media in ways that you couldn't before, but the basics have always been there. So in that sense, you know, maybe less has changed than we think. I would also say that the internet was really born of this unipolar moment. The internet has not existed in a world that wasn't peaceful, where we weren't moving towards globalization. And that's where it's going now. And it's less about, you know, how is the internet going to affect geopolitics? It's more about geopolitics is now saying hello to the internet and saying, huh, you thought that this was some kind of great network that was just going to communicate, that was going to connect everyone, and everyone was just going to communicate and understand each other. And it turns out that's not how it works. It turns out authoritarian governments can restrict the internet just like they can restrict what books you read or what gets said in newspapers, as they have for kind of hundreds of years. And that's what's happening right now. China was for a long time an anomaly in this way, the Great Firewall. It turns out it's the trendsetter. Russia has been doing it the past couple of years. I guarantee you're going to see other countries do that and try and control content on their networks and make sure that they can't be cut off from networks or have their own internal networks functioning forward. So in that sense, in a unipolar globalized world, the internet was able to do some really magical things. It will still do magical things, but it's going to be subject to national competition going forward. And you're going to have to get used to kind of moving in and out of different national technology spheres. It's not going to just be we're all on the internet hanging out. If you're going to exist in this ecosystem, probably you're going to have to signal who you are, where you're coming from. Do you have the right to be there? What can you can and can't say on those things? That's all going to be operative going forward.
Did you see the recent news? I think it was YouTube and a couple other Facebook. They're going to block or censor Russia TV or government messages coming out. It seems like, on one hand, I understand the stakes at hand, and let's say having misinformation or something, just the platform takes some liability or responsibility if people believe it and take action and spread that further, and it becomes mm-hmm. A tool to sway opinion toward that misinformation. But on the flip side, it's like there's a lot of gray area with so-called misinformation, who's to say, for certain things, I'm just saying it's a slippery slope, when a platform can censor and take someone off just because they don't like the message or they think it's going to be dangerous. Whereas what if it is not, what if it's just something that politically or worldview wise, the platform doesn't agree with, but inherently it's not, dangerous, or it's actually important to have an open discussion. And so you could say, hey, China and Russia are censoring or creating their own type of internet. But, since, I don't know when this started, I don't know what's your perspective, but it seems like with COVID, there's been kind of more of a crackdown on information. And now you have it just seems like the platforms are getting more aggressive in terms of what they're willing to crack down on. It's a different type of, it's not a closed internet, you would compare it to China. It's open internet, but it's not I don't know. It just is a weird aberration in some senses, of what maybe a lot of people thought the internet could be. Do you have any thoughts on kind of all of that?
Yeah, a couple. I'm a zealot when it comes to free speech. And I'm not a zealot about many things in my life, but I don't want anybody telling me what misinformation is. I would like to be able to determine what misinformation is for myself. I think there are some very, very bright red lines we can put around that. For instance, a video that teaches you how to make a grenade, I'm okay with censoring that. Anything that is directly supposed to be about harming someone violently. If somebody's teaching you a video how to hack someone's bank account, that should probably be taken down. I don't want to see that. But anything else, if it's an opinion, I don't care how ridiculous or evil or crazy it seems. I want to be able to read it. It's much more interesting for me to read Russian press in the morning right now than it is English press, and it makes my job harder when they're blocking Russian websites, because I need to know what the Russians are thinking. That's the only way to kind of know what's going to happen next. The other thing I would say, though, and this is the counter argument to my radicalness about free speech, and this goes back to something Tony Jutt said, I think in 2008, there's a YouTube clip of him giving a speech at NYU that was absolutely brilliant. And he closes the speech by saying that the real threat in the Western world, and he was really talking about the United States, but in the Western world, it wasn't the will to power of any sort of odious tyrant, but rather the will to ignorance of society that was really going to doom democracy if that's what was going to happen to it. And I really do feel that way, because my world in which there's, you don't censor anyone, only works in a world where people aren't ignorant, where people pay attention to what they're consuming in the media in the same way they might consume food. Not all of us, but many people think about what they put into their bodies in a really intentional way. I treat media and books and all that sort of stuff the exact same way. I want to make sure that I'm getting a healthy dose of all the things that I need. I'm very skeptical of some of these other things. Sometimes it's nice to have dessert. Sometimes you just want to watch the guy, go off on a take that you really agree with, but that shouldn't be the thing that you always watch. There's always kind of a bit of nuance. So it's a scary world where not only do we have governments that are censoring information, but we're almost self-censoring because we're hiving off in our own places where we feel comfortable, where the takes are the ones that we expect, where they're already right. I always watch the news stations that I disagree with when a major event happens on the news, because I know what they're going to say on the station that I believe in, or that most accords to my political views. I'm interested in the views that aren't mine, but that's a minority and lonely position. I know I'm doing my job right, actually, usually when I get hate mail on videos or podcasts that I do and both sides of the aisle are yelling at me. That's how I know we're doing a good job. And one of the problems is the voices that are willing to do that are less and less, and the platforms where you can speak to both audiences are becoming fewer and fewer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. Definitely interesting times we live in here. Jacob, I want to thank you for coming on and diving into a discussion on Ukraine, the world, many different important topics. Appreciate it. Hey, is there any, I want to, carry on these type of conversations with some others that might be in the field of geopolitics and mm-hmm. where the world's headed. Are there any kind of like one or two people you think that, you know, people could maybe watch their videos or learn from it? Maybe I could, you know, also, and, you know, potentially have a conversation with to nerd out on some of these topics, maybe from different angles as well.
Sure. Well, the number one person is Marco Papich. He's at Clock Tower. The Clock Tower Group. He's been on my podcast a fair amount too. We actually did a Russia-Ukraine episode, so he's very good. Peter Zeihan is another geopolitical expert. He can be a little sensationalist, but he's always interesting. As I say about Peter, he's very interesting, and sometimes he's even right. George Friedman was the guy who kind of taught me what I knew. I worked at Stratfor, and he was the one who founded Stratfor. And then Robert Kaplan is he's a great synthesizer of a lot of these different viewpoints. And really, I appreciate Robert because he thinks about things from as much of an objective point as I think one can. So awesome. That's the list I would give to you. And Marco, I'm pretty close with Marco. So if you wanted me to put you in touch with Marco, I'd be happy to do that. The others I'm less in touch with these days, but they're all great people to learn from.
And then what is your podcast?
So the podcast is the Perch Pod. It's you can find it on the Perch Perspectives website if you want, or it's an Apple podcast, all the place that you get podcasts and things like that. But it's once every 2 weeks, just hour-long conversations with geopolitical experts, either in the United States. I mean, my favorite episodes are, I had a Russia analyst on a couple of weeks before the war. I had a, you know, European military analyst on just last week.
Awesome. Yeah. It's awesome stuff. Definitely check that out. I'll link to your Twitter profile in the video description below. Also to your Perch Perspectives website. Anywhere else people can follow you?
The Cognitive Investments website too. We should link folks to. So that's just cognitive.investments.
Okay.
Perch. I write a monthly geopolitical column at a kind of a startup financial media publication called Lykeion. Spelled Lykeion. Perch, Lykeion, and CI are the places to find me.
All right. Awesome. Jacob, awesome. Thanks for coming on. And we'll talk to you again.
Thanks so much. This was great.
Okay. We'll see you. Bye.
Cheers. Bye.